Welcome to In Their Own Words, the audio memories of leading members of the British Tennis Journalists Association. In this edition, Honorary Vice President Nigel Clark, tennis writer for the Daily Mail, Mirror and Express, discusses covering Wimbledon for more than 50 years and reveals the truth about that famous press room brawl at the championships.
Well, Nigel, you started covering tennis, but you're also heavily involved in football. How did you manage to marry the two together? Which came first?
In a funny way, I was always yearning for football to be the main sport I covered, but force of circumstance made it tennis, because in the early 1960s, we had some quite good players. We had Virginia Wade and Roger Taylor, and there was some interest because everybody was geared to preparing for Wimbledon. And so we had Australians and South Africans and New Zealanders coming over to try and qualify for Wimbledon. And so I used to pick them up at little tournaments like Beckenham, Surbiton, Eastbourne, Priory. You have to remember that in 1961, Angela Mortimer actually won Wimbledon, beating Christy Truman in the final. And that sort of sparked a lot more interest. And then, of course, the real boom came in 68 when sport went on the back page. It's inconceivable when you realise that England won the Football World Cup in 1966 and there's no back page sport. But in 68, Wimbledon went open. So suddenly everybody was now targeting Wimbledon even more, and that meant an influx of foreign players wanting to get on to tournaments and qualify and practice. By now, the football season had tailed off, so guys who covered football like myself suddenly found themselves covering tennis, and it was good fun, and it was different because everybody was so helpful. Everybody wanted to have their name in the paper. There wasn't the television coverage. And suddenly, you could go to little tournaments like Beckenham and Surbiton, watch the players, have a beer with them afterwards, sit with them, talk with them. And it was a great comradeship that you could share with these people, good Aussies, good South Africans, good New Zealand boys, all in the mix that was Wimbledon qualifying. So it was funny that suddenly I was distracted from my passion for football into a passion for tennis, which has also helped because it was so social. Lots of meeting, lots of get together, beers afterwards in the clubhouse. And it started from there, really. And I began to realise that in those days, the tennis writers, the doyen tennis writers, were guys like Peter Wilson, the man they can't gag, Laurie Pignon, and Lance Tingay, who only really wanted to write about backhands and forehands. Well, we saw these people come onto the scene, people like Chrissy Evert coming onto court and her diamonds in her ears and gold bracelets and all that. And we started to write about people rather than players. We always said, well, somebody hitting a great backhand across court doesn't mean much in the back streets of Derby. But a tennis player coming on with a very sort of a smart, sporty way with short skirt dripping with jewellery became interesting. We knew that most people would never get a chance to go to Wimbledon and see it only on television. So we tried to inform people what they were looking at, who the players were, what they believed in, how they believed in being smart and well turned out. So we had this vision of a very glamorous sport, and the people who participated being pleased to sit and talk with you. You could sit and talk to Chris Evert or Martina, people like that, and it was fine. Of course, once Wimbledon went open, the challenge was keep the press away, because players no longer needed the oxygen of publicity because we're getting paid now. So it was different. But it was great while it lasted. It really made it fun to be a reporter. And it made it fun to be involved in something that was happening. And you have to remember, after 68, 71, 72, we had the Stasi turn up, Bjorn Borg, John McEnroe. The Stasi was funny. He would borrow somebody's umbrella from the crowd and go and stand on the baseline to return service. Well, that had never been seen of at Wimbledon before. And this was rather frowned upon by the old doyens, Pignon Long and Pignon Wilson and Tingay. They didn't think it was very funny. They thought it was rather demeaning. But crowds loved it. So we wrote about these people. And you had Nastasi coming into the press room to talk to you, to say, who wants to talk to me? Unheard of. The older generation didn't like it. Well, who's this? What's he want? What's he doing here? But for us younger guys, same age, we got on great together, and tennis became really a very glamorous sport.
In terms of facilities for journalists, when you were at Wimbledon, Nigel, how had they changed when you first went? What did it constitute?
You had to have 4 pennies in your pocket, because that's what you put into a public phone box. 4 pennies, and you got the operator, reverse call to London, please, blah, 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 blah. And you got through, and you got somebody in the office who put headphones on and took your copy down on the telephone. And we had one little old lady sitting on a keyboard by a table putting these calls through for the Americans and the Australian journalists, who were having to do everything from a public kiosk. And I can remember some of these public kiosks were filthy. I went in there one day to find my copy over there, and a dog had done his business in there. So you had to sort of confront the tennis was moving ahead at 100 miles an hour, but not in some aspects. We were a bit of a nuisance until they'd worked out how good we were for the sport.
The relationship with the club, did they make a press room available when you first went to Wimbledon? Was there something like a press room?
Underground cabin as a working place, and they didn't really listen to our needs very positively. That's how something called the Lawn Tennis Writers Association was spawned, because we got together to fight for better conditions, because we had a grey wickerwork table with 6 wickerwork chairs around it. And that was the writing room as such. And even when Wimbledon went open, it was still a bit basic. You have to remember, in 1968, the first Wimbledon Open was won by Rod Laver. Prize money, £2,000. The women's title was won by Billie Jean King. Price, 750 quid. So it's very low scale. And we were fighting for something which we could recognise the new revolution that was happening. It was exciting. But Wimbledon were a bit slow to embrace it. So they weren't really too enthusiastic about it. As things changed, they did become more progressive. They did understand what was going on, but they still really thought Wimbledon was an oversized garden party.
And in terms of the other Grand Slams, I know Australia didn't come to the party in terms of being recognized as big as the others to much later, but did the British press get to go across to the US, to the French?
Well, I certainly did, and France was always the best one, because everything in Paris stops for lunch, as you probably know. So tennis was scheduled around lunchtime, and also no play after 9 o'clock, because dinner time was more important than watching a doubles match. But we had some good players, and we had personalities, i.e. Nastasi, and then obviously McEnroe, Borg and all that. And they were very, very popular. And because of their success, they forced the tennis authorities to become much more publicly conscious. At Roland Garros, we had about 10 ladies behind booths that you could go up to and say, can you get me a call to London, please? And they'd put you through to a little box, and you had a little booth where you sat there with your copy. USA was different. You were parked in a massive grandstand for 10,000 feet above the court. You couldn't see anything, and it took you ages and ages to get a call through. But of course, the time difference helped a bit. But really, what was happening at Wimbledon was the forerunner, because we had the personalities there. We had guys who made the news. We had Nastasi upsetting Colonel Mike Gibson, the umpire, shouting with him, hollering, hooting. We had McEnroe behaving badly. We had Chrissie Evert, who always looked so nice and feminine and all that, and friendly. And other people looked at Wimbledon and realised that something special was going on. It was happening.
So when you had all these fantastic players, you could get used to chatting with them in bars and getting close to them. When did it change, Nigel? When did it suddenly the shutters go up and it became more difficult to get close to them?
Mr. McEnroe had a fun time at Wimbledon when the previous day he had been seen in his car with a girlfriend, I think it was Stacey Margolin, and that they were spotted driving down Wimbledon Church Lane by some of the news reporters, because in those days, because of the advent of Backpage and the personalities involved, it was very important that the newsmen had access to press conferences. And one day, this English newsman said, "Can you tell us, John, who was sat there with an inevitable smirk on his face, and why were you out at 8 o'clock in the evening driving a sports car with a girl?" And he shrugged his shoulders, and an American guy said, "Hey, yeah, what is it, you guys? Why do you do this? Why do you bug our guys? Why do you just write about the sport?" And another American, a rather large guy called Charlie Steiner from, I think, HBO, and he said, "They do it because they're all swear words, beginning with C." So I said to Charlie, "Well, don't be like that. We're just trying to get to some common ground here where we can all work together." He said, "I don't give a shit. All you guys are blah, 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 blah." I said, "Well, that's three times you've sworn. You shouldn't do that in front of ladies, Charlie. You're out of order." He said, "I don't care because you're the biggest of all." So what happened? I gave him a slap. And down he went, and he was a rather big guy, Charlie, and I thought, well, he's down, I better keep him down. So I threw myself on top of him and put the knee in as well. And I looked around, Arthur Ashe was standing there waiting to come in, and he went white. He actually went white. And then I remember there was nine of us writhing on the floor, grovelling and all that. It ended, and I got to my feet, and I was absolutely distraught, so I'd lost my comb, because in those days we all had hair down my shoulders almost, and in the melee of my coat, I'd lost my comb. I was distraught about that, much more so than what happened in the press room. Anyway, McEnroe looked at all this and walked out with a sneer on his face, and across the hubbub obviously was picked up by Wimbledon very quickly, and they sort of tried to quiet it all down and draw a line under it. But it was quite remarkable, because suddenly it was at war zone. We were told we couldn't do this, we couldn't do that. In future, we couldn't go into the interview room without a chaperone who sat there. That's what started chaperoned interviews. A player would go in there with a member of the association to make sure we didn't ask any more risky questions. But I mean, that was such an ordinary question to ask, but you have to remember there was always that little animosity there, because in one press conference, an American journalist asked John McEnroe, if he was a tree, what would he be? And we went, "What are you talking about? What sort of tree would you be?" And that's the kind of storm that went on. And that was the kind of question that made the rivalry quite bitter. So it was obvious something was going to happen sooner or later. And it was just sparked off by Mr. McEnroe, who, to his credit, always saw the funny side of it. A few years later, I was in a bar in New York, Upper East Side, and he came in with father. It was middle of January, up to your backside in snow, and Mac had his black glasses on and a bomber jacket, and Mr. came swaggering in with his fur coat, and he saw me there, and he said to me, "Hello, P-R-I-C-K. I said, "Oh, takes one to know one." He said, "Oh, he's still writing shit. Yeah, still speaking of Mr. McEnroe." And that was the kind of dialogue we had with them. It was sort of a bit naughty, but tongue-in-cheek. And I think Mac quite enjoyed the aggravation, because it propelled him into a world superstar. He blew down the walls of Jericho at Wimbledon by taking him on and not doing this and not doing that, and calling Ted Tindley the player liaison, all the names under the sun, and he got away with it. Of course, he was a great player as well. People forget that. McEnroe could have made his own headlines by just being a great player. But there's always an edge with John. Still is. And he still talks about it.
Now, Nigel, what happened to you as far as the club and any repercussions of the famous fight?
The club sent for me. I was paraded before in the committee room, and there was a guy called Buzzer Haddingham, who was the chairman. And he said, right, says young Clark, perhaps you'd like to explain what happened. And I said, what happened? I didn't withdraw from the four letter words. I gave him the lot. What happened? He said, stroking his chin, I rather think I would have done the same thing, but in future, if it happens, do it outside. So I said, sorry, boss, I'll do that. But I had people follow me around for weeks after that. In the September, I went to Flushing Meadow for the US Open. There was a press conference, McEnroe. Everybody walked in. I sat fairly near the front and I looked around me. I was aware that the five seats in front of me, either side of me and behind me, were all empty. Nobody would sit anywhere near me. I was kind of a pariah. So I just sat there. There's masses of people in there, but nobody wanted to sit next to me. I don't know whether they thought it's going to kick off again, but that was when people shout out, hey, Rocky. And I said, unbelievable, unbelievable.
Looking back on that, Nigel, do you still think it was the right thing to do at the time?
I was a bit cross with Charlie. The interesting part of that story is that even later, I went to Las Vegas for Bruno and Tyson, world title fight. And we got to the marquee on the before press conference day, and HBO had organised a brunch for journalists. So we were all invited. We were looking forward to good old lunchtime scoff. And I go then, there at the door as the greeter was 6'6" Charlie Stein. I thought, oh, Christ. So I thought, this is going to be interesting. So you know when you're confronted by danger, well, I always used to make sure. My father said to me, be first. So I just got my room key out and put it in my knuckles, knowing that if I was going to have to battle again, try and draw the first blood. Anyway, I walked up to the door, and there's Charlie, and he saw me, and he came out, and he enveloped me in this massive bear hug. He said, my boy, my fighter, how are you? And I thought that was very classy. But I did later understand and find out that Charlie's version of the events was totally different to mine, that I was the one on the floor and he was the one with his foot on my chest.
Nigel, the whole press thing has changed. The way that we cover tennis has changed. It's much more impersonal. Do you bemoan that? Do you look back with much more fondness now on the memories of your time when you were there with John Parsons and John Roberts and all, if you like, the old timers?
I only think about 365 days of the year, because it is absolutely has changed out of all recognition. It was in those good old days. It was not only fun. You produced stories. It was in lovely settings like Roland Garros or Flushing Meadow or Wimbledon, which is always the eternal garden party, done beautifully, decorated brilliantly. And I bemoan it because it was fun. And nowadays, it's not fun because nobody is allowed to talk to anybody unless you're a chaperone. You can't get into locker rooms. You can't stop and talk to people. They're not terribly interested in the publicity side of things because they're getting so well paid, they don't need us to blow their own trumpet. So I always look forward to Wimbledon every year. The club are very kind to me when I cover my 50th Wimbledon. They gave me a very nice decanter and two wine glasses to go with it, beautifully engraved. I realised the other day why I couldn't find them. I found that inadvertently I'd used one of the glasses for Terps. So I'd clean the garage and used to put Terps in. But anyway, I'm sure they'll forgive me for that. But it has changed, and it's sad that it's changed. It's not going to get better. And look at the pressure some of these girls are on. You've got the Wimbledon champion wanting to quit because of stress. What's going to happen to Maria Kenyon? How is she going to do well if she hasn't won a match yet? She's got more sponsors, starters and titles. Incredible. She's going to be under scrutiny for 12 months of the year, and she's a kid of 19. She needs careful guiding, and that's why tennis is not the fun it was, because it's a business now. It used to be a sport. I think the one thing I always talk about, which was absolutely breathtaking, was the McEnroe-Borg tiebreaker. McEnroe won it. I think it was 21-19 or something, and Borg then came back and won in five sets. He won the final set. And both players were throwing themselves around like goalkeepers. And it was a tremendously split crowd, all those from Akron one side, all those from Bjorn Borg. And Bjorn was another person. You could talk. I can remember a colleague of mine, Barry Newcomb. We were sitting in the Via Veneto, and Bjorn came and joined us at a table one day. And we were just sitting there chatting and all that. And he was singing little Swedish folk songs. He was just a very nice guy, our age, talking about things, football and all that. And I miss that part of it. And I always remember the part he played in it in making tennis so glamorous, Bob, because he inspired lots of teenage people. The girls at Wimbledon coming on centre court in their high-heeled shoes, all mobbing him and all that, and reaching out to touch him. It was mass hysteria. The first time it had been seen at that level at such a prestigious tournament. And it really made Wimbledon special to everybody. People used to love to watch it because they knew something would happen if Bjorn was there or if John was there. And those great years are the ones that we miss most of all because they were fun and they was, you know, McEnroe was a genius. It always surprises me, somebody of his ability, he never won the French championships. And that's what, for me, separates him from Roger. McEnroe was the greatest player I ever saw until Roger came along. But Roger only won France once, and so he found it hard. But what a great lad he turned out to be, polite, considerate, helpful. But without that mystical edge that McEnroe had, that Borg had, and in a certain degree, Connors had, because Connors and Mac were big rivals, and they went across the net to each other more than once. And once Jimmy Connors stood by the court with his bag open, and one of his children's toys spilled out into the court. McEnroe went over and crashed it with his racket. It was that kind of rivalry, that kind of, not friendship, but knowing that you're a comrade who could hurt you. And those two fought like Kilkenny cats. And it was a great time because it was real, real passion. And that's what, you don't have it so much today. It's all too perfect.